This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. Before we start, if you didn't catch it, Gabriel Rossman released the first episode of Right Tales. Gabe, do you want to tell us about it?
Sure. So it was me and Josh McCabe just basically talking about various issues. I want to have the caveat that it's a little bit dated and that I mostly sat on the production process for like a month. So for instance, we talk about Josh's experience at Wellesley, and we didn't mention that his program was just shut down like a week ago because it hadn't happened at the time we recorded. But that said, it's basically me and Josh talking about sociology and, you know, center-right politics. And we talk about various free speech controversies, including, you know, my deal at UCLA with that whole Milo business, his deal running a speaker series at Wellesley, which, like I said, has since been shut down. And we actually spend about half the podcast fanboying about Canadian policy and how Canadian policy is much more rational in all sorts of ways than U.S. policy.
It is true.
Wait, did the Freedom Project get closed down?
Yeah, my understanding is it did, which largely on the basis of people seeing it as like this Koch-funded thing. And
wait, you meant Coke, right?
Coke.
Yeah, Coke. Yeah, that's one of those things where you see it written all the time. I don't watch TV news, so I don't know how to pronounce things, right? Okay. So it was funded by them, but, you know, it wasn't like it was like people walk out of there as pod people with a copy of Road to Serfdom. It was just a speaker series, and at least when Josh ran it, he basically just used it as an excuse to bring in all sorts of sociologists. And so, like, Kim Whedon, you know, your kind of standard
Amy
issue.
Binder.
Yeah. So, I mean, most of these people are kind of your standard issue center-left Democrats that you see all over the place in sociology. And they're like, look, I was invited and I said exactly the same thing I'd say for any other audience. And, you know, like I said, when Josh ran it, he was basically just treating it as a sociology speaker series. Although I should also say, just not on the Wellesley thing, but just in general, it may be a while before another issue, because you'll know when you hear the episode before this one, I'm slammed with service, and Josh just had a new baby. So between both of our responsibilities, I don't know when we'll be recording the next one, but, you know, we'll do it eventually. It was a while between B-side episodes, but, you know, worth the wait, and hopefully it'll be the same with ours.
Yeah, I really liked the conversation. It was smart, policy focused, and had ideas that weren't from the 1980s. So I loved it, and I hope you guys do more. I'm happy to help.
Well, thanks.
All right, let's do it. So, who wants to? Should we start off with Starbucks?
Yes.
All right. Who wants to introduce Starbucks?
Well, Jean, I think you wanted to talk about Starbucks, so why don't you introduce the story?
Oh, okay. Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. I guess what I thought was interesting about the Starbucks incident, which I guess happened at a Starbucks in Philadelphia last weekend, I believe, a white manager called the police on two African-American men who were waiting for someone to join them. I guess they had it ordered, so they were accused of loitering, and then it since has spurned various kinds of protests and calls for the manager to be fired, which I heard he or she voluntarily left. And then also, I guess I just heard that they're closing stores on May 29th for racial bias training.
Yeah, which is horrible, because what's going to happen is all of these people who can't get their lattes are going to be like, thanks, black people.
Okay, so I kind of wanted to discuss the substance of it, you know, and what happened to these two guys first. But, you know, since Leslie mentioned it, you probably saw that photo that was going around yesterday, or from the listener's perspective, like 9 days ago, of there's a guy with a bullhorn. And there's this barista standing there very patiently waiting to take somebody's order. And there's a guy with a bullhorn literally yelling in his face with the bullhorn. And so people were kind of captioning it. And one guy on Twitter had a caption for it where he said, like, extreme David Attenborough voice. And he's like, it is very rare to see the exact moment when someone decides he's going to vote for Trump for re-election. So,
yeah. The dude was just staring off into space. The thing was funny. But what do we think about this one? Was, first of all, I guess there's a few moving parts here, right? Yeah. There's the question of the Starbucks employee who called 911, how the police handled it, the guys and the afterward, the corporate response with the training. So should we take it from the top? Like, what's the balance of blame between the police and the Starbucks employee who called 911?
Well, I mean, both were necessary but not sufficient conditions, right? If you didn't have the Starbucks employees calling the cops, nothing would have happened. Something would have happened, which is that the guy's friend would have shown up and they would have ordered their coffee. But, you know, that's, you know, nothing bad would have happened.
Except they would have had really bad coffee.
Yeah, that's right. They would have paid $4 for burnt coffee.
Yeah.
If the police had arrived and then de-escalated the situation and just said, what's going on here? And the guys told them, and they listened to the other customers who were apparently standing up for them. And they said, we were just waiting for our friend. And, you know, then we were going to buy coffee. And then the police either said, okay, well, if you'd still like to buy your coffee, you're welcome to do so. Or if the police just said, well, I'm sorry, but the management asked you to leave and it's private property, so we have to force you to leave without arresting them, then also nothing or almost nothing would have happened. You needed both the store management and the cops to screw up in order for this to turn into the incident that it did.
Yeah, I think you're totally right, Gabriel. Totally right.
You know, this rush to call 911 is like, I remember that was what happened with Tamir Rice, right? Like somebody just saw a kid playing with a gun in a park and decided to call 911.
Well, wait a minute. If you actually thought, I mean, the problem with that is that it was a toy. But if you actually saw someone with a gun, I think calling 911 is the appropriate response. Although it does lead to tragic situations like Tamir Rice and Daniel Shaver. Both of whom were responses to man with a gun calls.
Yeah, 911 seems like a lot for somebody who's not coming out of a store, although I guess stores want the right to tell people to leave. What do you guys feel about
that? Well, I mean, apparently people call 911 for all kinds of things, right? Yeah. Like, oh my goodness, like the moon is shining in my window. No, like seriously, I was like, if you guys ever listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's like, I kind of feel like one of the recurring questions, like always ends up with like what someone called 911 for. And they are really frivolous things. The difference is those people then don't end up getting arrested because of their frivolous calls to 911, right? I think Gabriel is totally on with his analysis. And the other thing is, I think that it's yet again another signal of like how much more we value private property and property rights than, than human rights, right?
Yeah, I was about 5 minutes from calling 911 last week when we couldn't get Zencastr to work for 40 minutes.
Does anyone know for sure, like, what it meant for them to say that when it was said that they refused to leave the restaurant? Because that's what I can't get clarity on.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. Does anybody?
Because I think it's like it was a sort of a thing where they said, you have to order something. They said, no, we're waiting for someone. And then the manager called 911 anyway. Or like, what was that actual exchange? That's what I find really odd. Or one thing I find really odd about this whole thing.
Yeah, that's a big one, right? Like, what about, I assume the guys didn't buy a coffee. And I would imagine that they said, look, guys, you got to buy a coffee. And they said no. And that adds a layer of complexity there, right? Like, am I allowed to go into a restaurant and like open up my computer and start working there? And if somebody says, sir, you have to order something and leave, can I say no? Like, where, and if I do say no, is somebody allowed to call the police on me?
Even before that, like, what is the likelihood of a manager coming up to someone and asking them to order something if they just pull out their laptop? You know what I'm saying? Like, is it that sort of where the racial bias gets introduced?
I mean, growing up in New York, like, you could never just go in a place and sit down. I mean, what kind of foolishness is that? Right?
Yeah, that's my
thing. You know what I mean? It's like, you got to buy something or that's it. You got to get out, right? So that's how I grew up, right? I live in Bethesda now, right? And even in DC, you can walk into a Starbucks. And most of the time, people will leave you alone as long as, it's not really, really crowded, which seemed very civilized to me, right? Mm. So my question is, and I think this is where people have actually been trying to be very careful is, well, what was the actual policy at this given Starbucks, right? Like, and if there was a policy that, tables are just for paying customers, was there signage? Is this a policy that they actually implemented all the time, right? And evenly? Because I think that's kind of like where the problem it gets introduced, right? We have these supposedly colorblind policies that then get enacted in ways that are not free of bias at all, right? And then you end up having to do bias training and closing down your Starbucks.
Yeah, and then getting everybody mad at your wings, right? No, but in all
seriousness, the black people, not at Starbucks.
You're gonna be laughing with that. But in all seriousness, in New York City, that's how I see it through the prism of New York. Being in New York, and like New York, you sit down and they're like, here's your coffee, now get out. Yeah, and every minute you spend there, you feel shame because like, that's how it is. They want you out. I think in New York, just about anybody who entered a Starbucks and didn't buy a coffee would be out soon enough, you know? And I think it is reasonable to want people to buy a coffee. I feel like anybody would be thrown out under those circumstances, but you're right. I know the place on South Street. It's a busy place. I used to live in Philly when I taught at Temple University, and it's a busy and small Starbucks, but...
But it seemed like it wasn't that they were going to buy coffee. They were just waiting for their friend, right? So was it like, was it that also the issue that was weird?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like they said they were never going to buy anything there. I thought they were just waiting for their partner or whatever before they made that decision.
It's because I'm in an apartment with a bunch of CA people. You know, my rampant speculation about this is that it was kind of an escalation thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The manager approached them and said, you know, are you going to buy something? Because if not, you'll have to leave. And we don't know whether the manager would do that with everybody or he only does that with black guys. Presumably, they might have assumed that it was the latter. And so they got defensive, mm-hmm. basically, you know, took a position of, well, you're not asking everybody else to buy something before they leave. So we're not going to leave. And, you know, you basically saw the same dynamic with like the Henry Louis Gates arrest. Where, you know, you had a man trying to get into his home where he had a perfect right to be. To a caller, it looked like a housebreaker. And they called the police. And the police wanted to see ID to prove that it really was his home. And he kind of had the perspective of, this is my home. I don't have to prove to you why I'm in my own home. And it kind of escalated from there. And so it was kind of a, you know, you had two different views of the situation. And everybody sees it almost as like a point of injustice, as like a point of principle that I shouldn't have to prove to you that I have a right to be here because this is the type of situation that I know people will practice and it's unjust for them to do this. And so you'd end up seeing a process of escalation rather than de-escalation. That's just my guess. Like if we had a transcript of the interaction point by point, I would not be surprised. You know, I bet a dollar that that's how it went.
Who thinks Henry Louis Gates looks suspicious?
Well, he's like 70 years old. Yeah.
He doesn't really look like the burgling type, but...
I know. Right? And you would assume it's one of his neighbors. Don't his neighbors know what he looks like?
I think that's the craziest part of that story, actually.
Yes, right?
Crazy. I mean, I think that's actually the most interesting thing, is not that some manager overreacted and then the police overreacted and, you know, the customers may or may not have, you know, declined to de-escalate because they saw it as a justice thing. I think that's almost secondary to how Starbucks reacted, in that they had this process of, it's like in the Bible where some prophet comes to some king and says, you know, you have apostatized against Yahweh, your God. You know, you must have sackcloth and ashes and fasting and repentance. King bewails and says, you know, spare us from the Assyrians. You know, I feel like it's almost like that, where it's like we see a form of corporate penance and corporate atonement for a transgression that's associated with the corporation. You know, so the straightforward way to look at it would be like, oh, you know, here's this technical solution where they're going to bring in experts to ensure this doesn't happen again. I consider that naive. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, diversity training doesn't work. And we know that from reading Frank Dobbin. This is a great case for like neo-institutionalism. This is a pure ritual. And so what is the function of the ritual? I think that the function of it is not to ensure that this doesn't happen again, because, you know, a manager is going to say like, and that's when the training kicked in. Like, you know, oh, there's these two black guys who had training kicked in. I don't think that's going to happen. I think fundamentally, this is a ritual of atonement to expiate sin.
Yes, but I think it's a great ritual to enact. You know what I contrast it with is the Simpsons reaction to the problem with Apu. Have you guys heard about
that one?
I heard
about it, yeah.
I've heard about the controversy. I don't know what the reaction is.
Okay, so the deal was, just for listeners who don't know about it.
You don't know about the show called The Simpsons, yeah.
Yeah, you might have heard of that show. But there was a documentary film that came out that was talking about the problem with Apu. And it's basically the problem that the stereotype has posed for people of Indian descent and how, you know, it's a caricature that people don't like, and there's reasons for that. So The Simpsons sort of addressed it in a very oblique way on one of their episodes, where they basically just forthrightly said, what are you going to do? And they had them like they made a vague allusion to the incident. They basically said, in effect, what are you going to do? They stared at the camera and moved on. A lot of people interpreted that as somebody saying, we don't care, you know? And to my mind, yes, I don't think the actual training will do anything. But what Starbucks is clearly communicating publicly in doing this is that race relations and fighting discrimination and things like that are a priority to the corporation. It's not something that they're just going to dust off or explain away, but they're at least going to take some action.
Can you say it's a priority, though, if they only spend like a day on a diversity training, though?
So, Jean, I think that's an interesting question, right? Because the thing is, what their response brings up to me is like, well, you know, like this was in response to one incident by one individual who I think they could have just censured or fired or what have you. And I think that that's happened, right?
Yeah.
That's happened. And rather than doing that, they're like, no, you know what? We're going all the way. We are going to close, 8,000 stores, right? Mm-hmm. And we are going to forego revenue, right? Mm-hmm. For an entire day from these stores, right? As a sign, right? So it's almost like they're like, okay, fine. Like this is the tax that we're paying for what has happened. I don't think that they are under any delusion, right, that this is going to solve a problem. I think, though, they don't even really have a sense that this is a problem in all of their stores. They know for sure it's a problem in that store, right? Right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I find to be so interesting. I don't think that they think that this is going to solve racial bias, right? In Starbucks across the country, to the extent that there is racial bias. And the thing is, you never know. I mean, because you might have a manager in the store like this week, right? And like 2 months from now, you get a new manager who wasn't part of the training and whammo, it happens again. Yeah.
I think you have to give Starbucks some credit for caring about race. Do you remember that ridiculous campaign that they had where, the one where they were like, you want to talk to
on the coffee cups.
Yeah. Yes. I want to talk about race relations with the dude making my coffee.
I thought that was cool.
Oh, I thought that was awful.
I was like, what's the problem?
Imagine if you're working there and you don't want to,
I was thinking about the employees.
Yeah.
Who aren't necessarily like know anything about race, but they have to talk about it because it's on the coffee cup. Like, I just thought that was weird.
Yeah, I don't want to talk to a teenager about it. Like, half the kids at my Starbucks are 16.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Why do you have to be an expert? I think part of the problem is that the average person in America tries to pretend that race isn't an issue, right? And so by saying, hey, you average person who can afford, a 4-shot whatever coffee thing, right? Coffee drink. Hey, like, let's make you feel a little bit uncomfortable. Like, let's talk about it, even if it's just for a minute, right? And even if you don't want to have the conversation, you know what? You were in the store and there's the cup. And it's like, maybe you might not want to talk to the barista about it, but you might get to work and say, you know what? This weird thing happened in Starbucks today. I mean, I'm not saying that what they did was smart, but I got what they were trying to do, you know?
My thing with stuff like that, though, is like, how do you know it's over, right? Like, so it's just like a sort of flash in the pan kinds of things. And then you decide that like there's been enough race-related conversations, so you end that campaign. You know what I mean?
That's true.
So weird. And like, I thought about this actually when I was thinking about the sort of whole like safety pin thing that people wore after the Trump election. Mm-hmm. And it was a similar thing. It's like after a while, people stopped doing that and sort of like, but like nothing's really changed. People just stopped doing that. Like, so I just don't get the point.
I'm also thinking, like, Leslie seems to be presuming that she's going to be happy with the conversations that people would have. You know, I think you have to accept the strong possibility that you'd rather people just avoid the subject if you knew what they would say when they bring it up.
You know what, Gabriel? Actually, yeah. I actually wasn't presuming that I would be happy with the content of the conversation. But, you know, it's kind of like when Trump won the primaries and my students, many of my students were a little bit concerned and they didn't understand how this could have happened. And I said, well, with all of his racist rhetoric, they were like, there's no way anyone would vote for him. And I should, full disclosure, this was a race class, which is why people were focused on the race part. And, you know, and I remember saying, look, one of the good things about his nomination, right, is that at least now people are talking openly about things that they didn't say before. And now those of us who have been saying, actually, racism is a thing, we can say, look, you see, racism is actually a thing, right? It's like a good part to that story and a bad part to that story. The bad part is now that the cat's out of the bag, right? How are you going to get it back in, right? So I don't know.
I think that kind of thing is actually a positive feedback cycle. But if you look at the survey data on basically how many people think that racism is a severe problem, I forget exactly how his question was phrased, but it was something along those lines. That number rose throughout the Obama administration, Democrats, and then it stayed steady at a low level among Republicans. And so it's kind of endogenous, right? That this kind of, you know, and you could say that that's the correct position. I'm not even arguing whether it is or it's not. I'm just saying that this polarizing on this issue led to a backlash, which led to Trump. And so what you're describing is not people, oh, here's this teachable moment type thing. It's actually more process of polarization and people just getting more mad at each other.
Gene, you were talking about, is it going to stick? Probably not. But if the issue stays alive through a series of discrete events and just keeps it in the conversation, I think that could be good. Yeah, maybe it'll only last a month, but maybe when next month's race thing comes up, because I'm sure it will at this rate. Yeah. At least the Starbucks thing will be fresh enough in some people's minds that they'll be like, oh, yeah, race is still a thing, right? So it might be like that. One last thing I want to say about the Starbucks thing. Like, I had a friend. He was of Eastern European descent. He had a great affection for me, but he was clearly from a place where, like, they didn't like Jews very much, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember him complimenting me. He's like, yeah, I admire the Jews' ability to get a ton of money. Now, the deal was it was very misguided, but his heart was in the right place insofar as he was trying to signal acceptance, right? And I think maybe Starbucks is like that too. Like, I don't know if a day of training is going to do anything, but I do appreciate the fact that they even care about, like, they're not Chick-fil-A or something like that, right? They do care about the issue.
Well, Chick-fil-A cares about issues.
Aren't they the ones who don't like gays?
Chick-fil-A just concentrate on just selling chicken sandwiches and moreover being willing to do so on Sunday. People would be... they'd be much more popular in, say, New York. Yeah. People don't hate Chick-fil-A because it's amoral. They care about it because it has moral principles. They just disagree with those moral principles.
I was listening to some of the chants during the protest, and I'm sorry, it was hard not to be tickled a little bit. I think my favorite was a whole lot of racism, a whole lot of crap. Starbucks coffee is anti-Black, right? And I'm sorry. How is coffee anti-Black?
Well, if you put cream in it.
I'm just saying, I believe that institutional racism is real. I believe that systemic racism exists, right? Yes. And I believe that there is a whole lot of anti-Blackness in this country. How does the action of one individual make an entire corporation racist? So I'm just saying, people.
That only holds if this is the only time that something like this has happened in the history of Starbucks. I don't know if that's true.
Oh, I'm not saying it's the first time this has happened in the history of Starbucks, but it's not as though Starbucks has like an employee policy that instructs their employees to act that way. If people are going to be racist, they're going to be racist. But that doesn't mean that they're acting under the charge of the corporation.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.